Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 31st of July. Coming up on the program, the importance of climate change modelling in risk management. How will the amendments to the Companies Act affect the job security and disclosure concept? The tragic story of a lone zoo elephant and efforts to relocate him. The inspiring story of the Olympic Games' first quadriplegic photographer. And more opposition to the city of Johannesburg and its 200 rand prepaid electricity surcharge. The Reserve Bank governor has highlighted climate change as one of the key factors that could affect the economy negatively in coming years. He says it will now play a key part in the central bank's scenario planning. So how important is this statement? With us now is Isaiah Mtlanga, chief economist and head of research at Rand Merchant Bank. Welcome to you. And then how significant, in your opinion, is this decree?
It is significant, but I think it's not the first time that they have highlighted climate change as a big risk for the South African economy. I think the one thing that we all have to agree on with 100% certainty is that climate change is increasingly disrupting many economies, particularly emerging markets that are less prepared to deal with its consequences. In SA, you know the floods in Durban, the wildfires that happened in the Cape, but we also know some heat waves and droughts. Those are becoming frequent, and the costs to different sectors of the economy are quite hectic, to an extent that some of the sectors are finding it difficult to insure against those sort of disasters that emanate from climate change. Hence, the Reserve Bank's caution, or the Reserve Bank's announcement that the banking sector is exposed to these risks, and they will work with the banking sector to make sure that they improve their resilience to these shocks.
Do you think in the past, companies in South Africa, particularly banks, have been slow to respond?
It's not just an SA issue. It's really a global issue. The impacts of climate change are not well understood as yet. Even when you look at academic research that tries to get a sense of to what extent do asset prices take into account or reflect climate change risks, there is no evidence yet that suggests that financial markets actually have a climate change risk premium. That says to us, perhaps we are not actually accounting for the potential for disruptive impact from climate change, which then suggests that when the impact comes, it's going to be disruptive, but it's also going to be difficult to deal with. Hence, the need to build resilience across different sectors of the economy.
At what point do you think that that risk premium is going to be worked into the equation?
I think we have to experience several climate change events that are disruptive, either locally or in other countries, for us to get into a sense of a realization that these risks are now imminent. I think the difficulty is climate change impacts are slow-moving variables. They manifest over a very long period of time. So until there are a lot more frequent and disruptive events, it's going to be difficult for financial markets to easily price them in. One of the issues is lack of data in terms of the where they occur, what is the sort of impact, how much does it cost to insure. All of those things imply that it's not easy to assess the broad macroeconomic consequences of climate change. Hence, it's not yet priced in. Once data becomes more available it's going to be easier for financial markets to create some models of how climate change impacts the broader economy in a way that they can be priced into financial markets.
What then should the process be for effectively integrating climate-related risk into the so-called stress testing scenarios? In other words, the modeling that you're talking about.
So far, it really requires to generate scenarios that have either happened in other countries that are plausible and with medium to high likelihood of occurring, which is what the Reserve Bank have done with the insurance sector last year. And those scenarios could take the form of a shock to GDP, that is, say, a contraction of 2 to 3%. And then the financial institutions will have to stress test their balance sheet on the basis of that contraction in GDP to try and get a sense of what would be the impact on their balance sheet. But also, there are responses of bond yields, the responses of currencies and interest rates to a shock. The Reserve Bank then also creates some scenarios on what would be the response of these financial markets variables to a significant climate change event, and give those to financial institutions to assess their own balance sheet, how they respond to the changes in these variables. Therein, the financial institutions will be able to assess to what extent can they withstand those shocks. If they can't, can they insure against it? And if they can't, what would be the response, either to reduce the exposure to those sectors to try and mitigate against the potential, you know, a disruptive implication to their own institutions. I think that's where you know, the state stress testing is. They still need to develop better macro or economic models to understand the ripple effects throughout the economy, because the economy is linked across many sectors, such that an event might happen in the property sector because of floods, it impacts the insurance sector. If there is a large insurer, it has a potential to disrupt financial markets or to disrupt the, you know, the financial system. So those systemically important institutions exposure have the potential to have a much more broader impact. So all of those things are still worked out.
Is the banking sector in South Africa working sufficiently in a cooperative manner with the central bank to assist with this risk modeling? And if not, I assume you've got to accelerate the process slightly.
Look, to my understanding, they are working very closely with the Reserve Bank. It is in the interest of financial sector to make sure that they are resilient for all sorts of risks. But I'm aware all of the stress tests done by financial institutions in collaboration with the Reserve Bank. So sufficient work is being done.
Do you think there is enough data, particularly in developing economies, to make sure that those models are robust?
Not yet, which is why still an emerging academic field of study that is also quite early stages for central banks to look at. If you just consider the SARB, for instance, the first time that last year they have done stress tests for the insurance sector. So it just tells you that it's still an emerging field, it's emerging risk, which will take some time to fully understand. And there isn't much data across many emerging economies, which is why it's so difficult to quantify and get a sense of what are the potential implications for economies.
Of course, it's not just a Reserve Bank issue. It's a national government policy issue as well. And the greater cooperation in that respect is also required.
Absolutely. It takes many, many regulators and policymakers, not just the Reserve Bank. Even from a fiscal perspective, they also need to have a proper view and understanding, because when you have flood hitting an area, fiscal policy has to respond and try to assist and reduce at least how people are impacted. So fiscal policy would need to respond as well. So it's a number of regulators and private role players in the economy that need to be hands on deck to try and understand the implication and how to respond to it.
And the potential economic and financial consequences if institutions don't adequately incorporate climate change risk into their planning and operations could be dire.
Quite possible. I think that is the concern. We know climate change has negative consequences. What is unknown is how big the consequences are for different sectors of the economy. That is why the Reserve Bank is starting this work to do stress testing for the banking sector and the insurance sector, among others. It is to precisely understand how big the impact are and what would be the approach to mitigate against these.
Azayam Plunga, thank you very much indeed. Chief Economist, Head of Research at Rand Merchant Bank. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Many people have found this next story very moving. A lone elephant in captivity at Pretoria Zoo has been the subject of controversy for quite some time. But now the Shambala Private Game Reserve, it's north of Pretoria, has agreed to provide Charlie with a new home after a decision by the board of the South African National Biodiversity Institute, as well as the director of the Zoological Gardens. I'm in conversation now with Megan Carr, lead of the Towards Freedom Program and senior researcher at the EMS Foundation. Megan, thank you for joining us. Why has it taken so long, do you think, for authorities to make this decision? Patently, the animal was very distressed.
Hi, thank you so much for having us on your program today. We really appreciate it. I think any decision for a government takes a long time because it was quite a controversial decision. It's a very forward-thinking decision. If there's a few other countries in the world or cities in the world that have elephants in captivity and they are struggling to be freed for the same reasons, it's controversial, I think. We are very, very happy that after 4 years of negotiation, that both Minister Creasy and the government was in support of the decision.
Megan, explain to me why it was controversial.
Well, I think, you know, you have people that believe that zoos are educational and that that they are there to provide an opportunity for people who aren't able to see animals in the wild. And then you have the people that believe that in places like South Africa, there should be no elephants in captivity at all because we have elephants very close to us. And also, obviously, they're available on documentaries on your phones, even if you can't get to see them in the wild. So there are two camps. Those who are in favor of zoos and those who are not.
What's your view?
Absolutely not in favor of elephants in captivity.
So it would need then more specific policy or legislation then to guide surely the treatment and relocation of animals like Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, in South Africa, we have the Pretoria Zoo, which has one elephant or had one elephant, and Johannesburg Zoo has three elephants. The Pretoria Zoo was a government-run institution, so that is why we started a negotiation with them. The policy, yes, absolutely. If you Google and see how many countries are trying to change this policy, scientists and academics have studied elephants in captivity for many, many years, and it's a proven and known fact that elephants require a lot of area to move in. They need to move great distances in order to stay healthy. They need to be able to choose their own food, make their own decisions, and no zoo can really offer that kind of space.
What would this animal have experienced in captivity? My understanding is it wasn't ill-treated in any way.
No, not ill-treated in any way. It's just really that there's not enough space. An elephant in captivity can't make its own decisions about what to eat. So elephants know that they need to eat certain foods when they're feeling in a certain way. They're extremely intelligent. There's nothing to entertain him. You know, it's just the same routine every day, which is completely controlled by humans. He knows what time he eats, what time he drinks, what time he sleeps. And no animal, certainly not an animal as clever as an elephant, should have to be forced to make those decisions.
And how would that have manifested in outward behavior?
Stereotyping, which is when they sway back to front, just general not happy. So elephant behavior, it's studied Charlie closely for the last 4 years, have written reports about his behavior and have found that he is depressed and that he needed more stimulation. Animals definitely need stimulation, especially, as I say, they're so intelligent. You know, they need to make decisions for themselves. They're very curious. He's extremely an extremely curious elephant.
And just quickly, Megan, sorry to cut in front of you. Very quickly, incumbent on this private game reserve now to put in place, I imagine, proper measures for a smooth transition and to make sure that integration into a resident herd is managed properly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge undertaking, and there's no commercialization of this project at all. Shambhala has generously given to the project, given Charlie a huge amount of land. Initially, he'll be by himself as he slowly learns to be an elephant again, learns how to forage, learns how to find the water on his own. He'll be having to be fed initially, obviously, the same food that he's had here. He'll have to have company in the beginning because that's what he's used to. And we'll have to be watched closely to make sure that he's transitioning into a more natural environment as and how he wants to.
Megan Carr, thank you very much indeed. Lead of the Towards Freedom Program, also senior researcher at the EMS Foundation. I appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As the Olympic Games continues, Johan Mankies, the world's first quadriplegic photographer to shoot at the Games, really does exemplify South Africa's spirit of resilience and is now inspiring global audiences with this achievement. He's on the line to us now from Paris. And first of all, Johan, it's an incredible achievement. I'm assuming that you're enjoying the experience so far.
Jeremy, I'm enjoying it tremendously. It's a first time as a photographer, yeah, and these guys are helping me so much at every event where I go. I went to the gymnastics, I'm here at the swimming at the moment, and then badminton I did, and they're helping me quite a lot. So I'm enjoying it. First time quadriplegic photographer, yeah, it's quite a experience to do that. But I'm enjoying it.
Johan, what challenges then as a quadriplegic photographer are you facing at these games and how are you overcoming them?
Yeah, the biggest problem is getting to different venues. You know, they've got buses, but when you get there, the bus doesn't arrive, or sometimes the undergrounds, they're not wheelchair friendly. So we've got to know everything in advance to know how to get to some places. This morning, I couldn't get a bus, so we had to get a special taxi. They've got, I don't know how many, Toyota sponsored for the Olympics, and some of them are wheelchair-friendly, so they helped me in one of those, and I just arrived at the La Défense venue for the swimming, where Tatiana and them are taking part in the 200-meter breaststroke prelims.
And that's going to be a dream event to cover, I imagine, given her success previously.
The swimming is quite a big event. You can't get tickets as a photographer to the finals. We've got one or two photographers from South Africa that does that, but I couldn't get in for those big events. So I wasn't next to the pool when she won her gold. But this morning I've got one, so I'm going to go. It's not a final, but at least I'll be able to take some pictures of her.
Well, I'm sure they will be very, very good shots. Johan, you've covered many sports events. What is your favorite to shoot and why?
Well, obvious gymnastics. When I was younger, I did gymnastics, and that's why I got hurt in one of the competitions. I broke my C6 and 7th vertebrae, and since then I've been in a wheelchair. So I like to go to the gymnastics. Tonight I'm going to the men's final, individual finals. I'm going to take pictures there. And tomorrow will be the women finals. I'll be there as well. Swimming is quite difficult. I'm going to be there. And then later on in the Olympics, I'll be at the athletics as well.
On the flip side, though, you talk about gymnastics being your favorite sport. What sport do you find the most difficult to photograph and what would make it challenging?
Well, yesterday I was at the hockey and I had two difficult things. The heat was tremendous. It's a different kind of heat. We in South Africa we know about the heat, but it was different yesterday. So the hockey was a little bit difficult for me. It was difficult to follow the game. But normally I do rugby, and at the rugby, I get good pictures. But yesterday was a little bit difficult.
Johan, every photographer, I would imagine, has a dream shot that they hope to capture. Is there an elusive picture that you're aiming for at these Olympic Games?
Well, I got a very nice picture of Caitlin Rosenkrantz at the gymnastics. That was one event that I wanted to take nice pictures. And then, when is it? Tomorrow night, Simone Biles. I think she's going to be the world champion. Let's hope so. From America, I'd like to take a few nice pictures of her. And then all the South Africans, we go to different venues where the South Africans are taking part. I think this one where Tatiana is taking part will be one of my favorite photography events as well.
And Johan, it was a viral post from Gymnastics South Africa that has brought your story to a global audience now. You've got newfound recognition. How does it feel? How's it impacting you both personally and professionally?
Jeremy, that I don't worry about that stuff. Yeah, I'm just enjoying the photography. How I go viral or something like that, it's not important to me. I like to stay humble and influence people around me.
Oh, Johan, that is such a great answer. Let me also say to you that I think your career, from what I've read, has been a real testament to bravery, to passion, to resilience. What advice then would you give to aspiring photographers who might face their own set of challenges such as you have?
Well, every person has got his own challenges. I think photographers, they know what to do, and I don't think they've got so many things that they have to go past. But being in a wheelchair, I'd like to tell people in wheelchairs to take up photography and see if they can't get to take pictures all over South Africa and later on get experience, and maybe they'll also end up at the Olympics or something like that.
Johan Meintjes, from what we understand, the world's first quadriplegic sports photographer to shoot the Olympic Games. It's been a privilege talking to you. Good luck. Enjoy the rest of the event. And thank you so much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
President Ramaphosa has signed amendments to the country's Companies Act, which means that organizations could cut lower paying positions and their workers or pursue increased levels of outsourcing to circumvent the new laws. I want to make a little bit of sense of this. I'm joined now by André de Lange, Director Corporate and Commercial, Cliff Dekker Hoffmeyer Incorporated. And first of all then, André, how will these amendments affect job security, particularly among lower paid employees?
Jeremy, I think firstly it is just important to note that although the acts have now been signed by the president into law, they're not yet operational. So we're actually waiting for the president to determine an operational date for the amendments. So I think that's the first probably important point. I think what is interesting regarding jobs and employee-employer relationships, what the act provides is that in future public companies and state-owned companies will have to prepare remuneration policies and implementation reports and have these approved by their shareholders at their annual general meetings. And then the Act is very specific as to what you should include in those reports. And there that you they deal with things like the remuneration paid to the directors and prescribed officers, remuneration paid to the highest earner in the company, but also to the lowest earner in the company, and then almost a comparator between the 5% highest earners and the 5% lowest. So I think what will happen is it's now going to be very clear as to what the remuneration gap is between the highest and the lowest earners. So it could lead to a situation where companies will, beef up their remuneration for the lowest earners, because if the gap is very apparent and large, it could be quite embarrassing for companies to disclose that. So on the one hand, it can lead to an increase in minimum wages and also to reduce that gap between the highest and the lowest earners. Alternatively, it could also lead to negative things. For instance, it could lead to people getting rid of the lowest earners, or outsourcing staff that is on the lower income bracket in order not to have to actually disclose these huge discrepancies that there could be in some companies.
So this is a big debate about corporate transparency and obviously measures that would then need to be taken to prevent companies from outsourcing low-level jobs, particularly to circumvent new laws. How difficult is that going to be?
I think it would probably be quite difficult to do, because I think companies would, you know, it would actually, I mean, there's often some good reasons why companies outsource certain services. And I think to make a law that would prohibit that, I think that would probably not go down well. So I think that ultimately, it is also important that this only applies to public companies, yes, state-owned companies. So in other words, the bulk of the companies out there being private companies, it will not apply to them at this stage. So it might in future change, but currently it will only be those categories of companies.
But those companies also need to find a way of balancing the need for transparency with the potential risk of workforce reduction, and that's going to be difficult to achieve.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it would really be interesting to see what the impact of it is going to be. Because if you currently, there's already a provision in the Companies Act that your annual financial statements of public companies should actually disclose the remuneration of the top earners. And often it does not have the effect of reducing pay, but actually it rather has the effect of increasing it, because now everybody in the market knows what the CEO of Company X earns, and they then start benchmarking them against that. And so instead of actually leading to a lowering of remuneration, it actually sometimes often increases that. You know, so it has unintended consequences.
In terms of risk and application, what questions are your clients asking you right now?
Well, I think obviously, the larger companies, it's probably not something that they would necessarily want to disclose, the income gap. And I think the probably a worry that there could be is that it could lead to almost disgruntlement in a company, you know, regarding when these large gaps are becoming apparent. And it is now clear in the reports and in the financial statements of the company. So I think that can be a problem where companies, you know, the workforce can become disgruntled. I mean, there are reasons why there are gaps in remuneration. You know, there are good reasons why that is the case. But I think in South Africa, we're a society that gap is probably just too big. And hopefully it will lead to positive changes, but it is not clear whether that will happen.
André de Lange, Director Corporate and Commercial at Cliffdecker Hofmeyr, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And just a quick follow-up to a story we have covered in some detail previously. The Dear South Africa policy platform has launched a campaign to oppose the city of Johannesburg's controversial 200 rand surcharge for prepaid electricity. Joining me on the program now is Nolu Maki, who speaks for the organization. Welcome to you. Just remind me again what your principal opposition to this is.
So our principal opposition, firstly, thank you so much for having me, Jeremy. Our position is as a platform, we're giving people a crucial role to play, making sure that they can have a say on this. Of course, we are nonpartisan, so it's a platform for people to really share their views on this, because it is quite a concerning, this whole thing of this prepaid surges.
Concerning, in fact, you suggest that the surcharge combined with the latest tariff increase constitutes a form of double taxation.
Indeed. Currently, right now, as we know, people of Johannesburg, we are paying 12%. In fact, it's close to 13% right now in terms of tariff. Now, when you include this, it actually doubles it up, which makes it's not just going to impact individuals, but also the businesses, which means that might actually try to find that money back into increasing their prices. So it's not just one party, but us, but also multiple parties that actually can be impacted by this. So hence, we are finding it quite concerning.
You will concede that the city in this respect is facing a lot of revenue pressure. Are there other ways that the city could address this without, as you're suggesting, placing additional burden on residents?
I think currently, as we know, the city is also going through, this is caused by multiple things, of course, and such as I'm going through the I would say the lack of funds. So they should be finding creative ways as opposed to putting back the impact or the burden to the citizens who are already going through, knowing how tight the economy is, that they're going through so much when it comes to their finances.
So are you and other organizations, and there are numerous, engaging with the city of Johannesburg in this respect? And are you getting a satisfactory response if you are?
On our side, we aren't necessarily engaging with the city of Johannesburg, but rather we are just alerting people, making them more aware and creating a platform where they can have their views on this.
I'm going to leave it there. Nolu Maki, thank you very much indeed, speaking for the Dear SA platform. Just before I leave you, on our last online poll, I asked you about Jacob Zuma's expulsion from the African National Congress. And I asked you if Cyril Ramaphosa should be worried if the entire issue is irrelevant or expect more political spoiling. 70% of our respondents say the issue is of absolutely no concern at all. And this was our lead story today. And here's the question. Does your company have climate change risk policies in place? Yes, no, or you're working on it. If you have a view on that, please get hold of me either via X or on our LinkedIn platform. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.